The Major Spoilers podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, classic writers, legendary artists, and a typesetting machine. Must be time for some EC Comics as we delve into crime suspense stories. Lots of movies and shows are moving. Unions are on the rise and a new team of birds of prey are on the horizon. So add in some skinwalkers, some mobsters, and a barrel full of the patented Major Spoilers comparison contrast. You got yourself a piping hot dish full of the proverbial nerd-trition with a mushroom frisée, a white wine sauce, a fried egg on top, and Spam. And it's on the air.
Welcome to issue 1041 of the Major Spoilers podcast. Thank you for downloading and checking us out this week. We have a lot to get to later. I will remind people that September is National Crime Prevention Month. So what better way to celebrate than by talking about crime suspense stories? That's later in the show. But first, a little bit of news. Marvel Studios has rescheduled many of its upcoming shows on Disney Plus, in part to the WGA and the SAG-AFTRA strikes. Season 2 of What If has been moved to December 2023. It's an animated show, so no real reason on why they decided to move it. Echo, the spinoff of the Hawkeye series, has been moved from November 2023 to January of 2024. According to Variety, Disney plans to release all episodes of Echo at once to test binge releases on its streaming service. X-Men 97, the update to the animated X-Men show, has been moved from fall 2023 to early 2024. And Agatha, the WandaVision spinoff, is now set to debut in the fall of 2024 and has gone through yet another name change. Now it's being called Agatha Darkhold Diaries. Now, if you're freaking out because what does that mean? Are you going to get any Marvel stuff this year? Well, Loki Season 2 is still set to debut on October 6, 2023. Other shows Other shows that are still in production due to the strike include Daredevil Born Again, Wonder Man, and Ironheart. They need to finish their production, and then Disney will announce their potential release dates after the strikes have concluded. I don't know, especially the What If and the X-Men 97. Mm-hmm. There's not really a reason to move those just yet unless there's, you know, they want to coincide. I've said before, one of the nice things that Disney has done is they were coinciding or scheduling a lot of their releases so that if you're a nerd pop culture fan like us and you're like, the Star Wars show is over, I think I'll unsubscribe. Oh, wait, now there's a Marvel show. And then after the Marvel show, there was some other new. So they did really well on this. So I don't know if that's why they're doing this. But X-Men 97 was announced year and a half ago, I want to say, San Diego Comic-Con.
Season 2 of What If was announced like 3 years ago, it feels.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Are we saddened by any of this?
I'm saddened by the What If delay because I really enjoyed What If Season 1.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I feel like it, it had potential in ways that a lot of the TV stuff kind of doesn't, and I'd like to see a lot more of that.
Is anybody here upset because you just spent Labor Day weekend and you couldn't watch any new stuff because of those awful WGA and SAG-AFTRA people?
No.
Oh, okay, good.
No,
because you would have totally missed the point of the labor unions and what the WGA and the SAG-AFTRA are trying to do. That's the whole point of why you have Labor Day is because the unions went in there and rallied for the common man. And that's what the WGA and SAG-AFTRA are doing is they are trying to rally for their writers to get them better working conditions. So if you are one of those people, and believe me, I've seen a lot of comments on the Hellscape app that, remind me to talk to you guys about something at the end of the show that I should have brought up in the pre-show. But I see a lot of just out of touch people who are just like so angry at the WGA and SAG-AFTRA for going on strike because it means all of their shows are being moved and put off. And it's like, you are on the wrong side of that argument, dude. Mm-hmm. Of course, that person was David Zaslav, but there you go. What else is going on in the world of the entertainment industry there, Rodrigo?
Well, speaking of labor, a few weeks ago, we informed you about a potential unionization of Marvel Studios VFX crews. And now it looks like visual effects crews at Walt Disney Studios are moving in the same direction. Over 80% of the 18-member in-house visual effects members voted to unionize. If the Marvel and Walt Disney Studios effects crews succeed in their unionization efforts, they will be represented by IATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical State Employees.
This, that was a mistype by me. Stage employees. Sorry, Rodrigo. That was my
stage fault. Employees.
Yeah. Okay. I think this is a good move. We talked about this when the Marvel Studios voted to unionize. I just hope that it catches on. Unfortunately, so many special effects houses are starting to move overseas where the unions don't really impact them.
Yeah. I mean, I know that the UK has very bad acting union representation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure a lot of productions are moving there for the actors. And I mean, there's always been Korean and Chinese production houses that can do VFX for
your studio.
An absolute fraction of the price.
Yeah. I follow Jessica Hennick, who was in Glass Onion, the movie that's on that one streamer show. And I really wasn't aware of how bad some of the, I don't want to say conditions, but opportunities are for people in England specifically, and maybe even all across the rest of Europe. I think she may have been one of the early people to start talking out about this, is that if you don't have the money to get into these really good schools, you're out of the opportunities. And if you don't come from very good acting families, nepo babies, you also have few opportunities to get into really good acting parts or acting schools. So I was really surprised when this was during the press tour of Glass Onion that she was speaking out about that. And I was like, oh, very interesting. So
should she play Whiskey or did she say play someone else?
She was the assistant to the one actress lady in that movie. I forget what her name was. Peg. Her name was Peg. She played Peg in the movie.
Right. She was the assistant to Goldie Hawn's daughter.
Yeah, Goldie Hawn's kid. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's whatever her name is. Kate Hudson.
No.
Was she the one who was in Iron Fist?
Jessica Hennick? Yes. Correct. She was. Yes.
Okay.
And she even, she will even talk about why she gave up being in the Ten Rings movie. So she could be in Glass Onion. All right, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. She gave up being, she was going to be the part that went to, I forgot. It wasn't, not Ali Wong. Who's the other, who was the sidekick character in Ten Rings?
Awkwafina.
She was up for the Awkwafina.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, but she gave it up so she could be in Glass Onion. So there you go. All right, so that's some news. Dear listeners, if you have any thoughts about this, or if you've got a lot more thoughts, I'm sure you do, then you need to head over to the Major Spoilers Discord server. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server for free, and we would love to see you over there. There's a lot of stuff going on. I didn't think we should really tease this for the Top 5 podcast, but if you don't listen to our Top 5 podcast, last week was Top 5 Soups, and I really didn't think that there was going to be a lot of activity in the Top 5 Discord server channel. But holy cow, people are popping off in there telling us about their favorite soups. So you want to talk about the WGA and SAG After Strike, you can go do that. You can talk about this show. There's something for everybody when you join the Major Spoilers Discord server. And best of all, it's free. Let us now jump into a few reviews. A lot of comic books coming out this week and next week. Coming out today, as of this recording over at DC Comics, it's Birds of Prey number 1. A brand new Birds of Prey series is kicking off, and you can get it digitally or at your bookstore if your bookstore celebrates Tuesday New Comic Book Day releases. Matthew, what's going on in the Birds of Prey?
Birds of Prey. So Birds of Prey, you may remember. I remember reading the first issue of Birds of Prey back in 1995. And the Birds of Prey have always been a series centered around Black Canary and Barbara Gordon as either Oracle or Batgirl. So this series, issue 1 written by Kelly Thompson, art by Leonardo Romero, who I keep wanting to call Leonardo Rodrigo, and so I blame you. But this starts with Black Canary in her home talking to Green Arrow about how he's useless and he feels bad. And she's like, I have to do this, but there's one condition. I can't even tell Barbara what's happening. And so there was a lot of discussion and a lot of complaints that I recall on the interwebs when this new Birds of Prey lineup was revealed and it omitted Barbara Gordon as Oracle.
Yeah, I think my comment at the time, I think my comment at the time was, yeah, it's because Barbara Gordon is the one that's been kidnapped or gone missing, and they're going after her. That's what I thought the plot was going to be.
Thankfully, it's not that. I would have been mad about that.
Why? Because I was right?
No, because she was Batgirl. You don't just steal a Batgirl.
I mean,
you know, this is something different where Black Canary has been told that she has to save her adoptive sister, known as Sin. Used to be called White Canary, but I think that code name has passed on. But she can't necessarily work with her regular gang of idiots or friends. Sorry, that's a Mad Magazine, the regular gang of idiots. So she has to go out and find a new group of people. And she has to basically, she has to balance out, I need the most dangerous people I can find that I can also trust. So you could go and you get your Lady Shiva, but you can't trust Lady Shiva any further than you can spit. However, her daughter, Cassandra Cain, who is currently a Batgirl, I think. Yes. They call her Cassandra throughout this issue. She's utterly formidable, and she's not necessarily somebody that Barbara Gordon is going to figure out is missing. And then you're like, okay, I'm going to go get this guy, and you get the other guy. So you get this wonderful moment of Cassandra Cain walking into a fight and getting punched in the face. And the person who punched her in the face is like, oh, my apologies, small bat. I mistook you for one of these vampire idiots. And she is, she has come to find and recruit Big Barda of New Genesis. And then Black Canary goes and she has to find somebody equally dangerous and damaged. And so she goes and finds Zealot, late of the Wildcats. You guys remember that all of those properties, those Wildstorm books, are still in the DC universe, right?
Every time somebody says something like that, I have the same like startled panic attack reaction. It's like somebody will be like, blah, blah, blah. And then Grifter shows up and I'm like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't
know. So Grifter, all of those guys, Grifter, Zealot, Maul, Speed Buggy, whoever that guy with thing is. Yeah. Yeah. All of those guys, Dr. House, everybody from Gen 13 and the Jim Lee books is still there. So if you remember Zealot is a warrior of an alien, basically alien samurai. We'll just call them alien samurai.
here's all I can tell you about Zealot. Platinum hair, chrome and purple costume and swords, and very little of the chrome and purple costume. Oh, yes. And face paint. Yes.
Yeah. Zealot wears a lot of red and black, which I completely approve of in this issue. And since really we haven't seen Zealot in a very long time, and since we have, we've come into the post-rebirth, post-Dark Crisis era where everything she knew is back. I kind of want to see where this goes because ostensibly everything that ever happened in the DC universe is now back in canon, which is why this storyline about finding Sin is important. We haven't seen Sin since like 2009. But if Zealot's backstory is still there, then we may be able to see some of the stupid stuff that happened in Image Comics in the 2000s. But that's neither here nor there. And they're like, okay, well, we need one more guy. We need one more person. You know, you got the bruiser. You got the assassin. You got the straightforward killer. You got the leader. What do you need? What do you need? You need your wild card. And so Cassandra is like, I know a lady. Her name is Harley Quinn. And everybody says, absolutely not. And they spend about four pages saying, absolutely not. And that's when Harley Quinn decides that she's going to be a part of the team because she hears them saying that Sin has been kidnapped. And Harley's like, you do not mess with cool-ass little girls. I'm here to make sure cool-ass little girls grow up to be cool-ass women. And I'm just like, that right there, you could never have given me a better raison d'etre for however one pronounces that, for Harley Quinn in this new DC universe where she's sometimes a villain, she's sometimes a hero, she's always, you know, unpredictable. But that line, I'm just like, okay, I'm in. And then, of course, the last page gives us the thing that actually excites me about this issue. I'm not going to tell you who it is, but I will tell you that somebody, the somebody who has told Black Canary, you need to do this and you can't tell Barbara Gordon, shows up. And I'm just like, oh, that person still exists. Oh my gosh. So you got good history. You have a really interesting balance of characters. You have Black Canary in a leadership role. I'm really interested in the art. Romero's art is, I don't know, it feels like it almost has like a the Brothers Hernandez kind of vibe, not quite to the point where it gets really, really stylized and almost like, you know, stamped beautiful near the end. But near the beginning of the Palomar storyline, I really, really enjoy it. And I do love the redesign of Cassandra Cain's Batgirl headdress to look like the original Bob Kane Batman helmet hat from 1939. I feel like that's a perfect use of that silhouette. There are a couple of issues, for me at least, with the coloring. I feel like, especially DC, but you know, Marvel and Dark Horse do this too. They really lean hard into like pastels, and their whites all turn kind of an orangey yellow to try and give you this, we're fighting at night, but we're under a sodium arc light thing. And it just, I don't know, it weighs on me that there's three characters in this book who either have white hair or wear white, and there's not a true white anywhere to be had in the 22 pages. That said, still a 4-star affair. 4 slices of the magical meatloaf for Birds of Prey, Volume 5, Number 1. If you've never read Birds of Prey before, this may be a book to pick up for you. This might be a place where you can say, hey, I kind of feel this concept. If you have read Birds of Prey before, like I know I have, I feel like this is a really nice, respectful way to go, here's something entirely different, but we're not going to completely discount what has come before. Art is good. Story is interesting. So 4 slices of meatloaf. I'd say check it out, especially if you're Rodrigo. I think you might want to check it out.
All right. Okay. Thank you for that. Matthew, what do you guys know of a little place called the Skinwalker Ranch?
Isn't that where George Lucas built ILM so that they could do the effects for all of his Star Wars movies?
No.
That's Skinwalker Ranch. Oh. Skinwalker Ranch is when you take aioli and you mix it in with ranch dressing.
No. I think you're thinking of like a barbecue ranch. This, I know, the Skinwalker Ranch is where they had that HBO series set in the brothel in Nevada. The
nope,
secrets of
you
Skinwalker
are all
Ranch.
Wrong. Skinwalker Ranch is this place in Utah that has a lot of high strangeness going for it. If you're familiar with George Knapp, or if you're familiar with Colm Kelleher, they have appeared on Coast to Coast AM for decades now, both with Art Bell and George Norrie, and probably Ian Punnett and others that have been on the show talking about the skinwalkers, the people, the natives peoples who are able to shapeshift into wolves or other things. And maybe it's not just the Native Americans doing this, but maybe it's aliens from outer space, or maybe it's temporal distortions, or whatever thing that these two have come up with to sell more books and TV series and whatnot. In fact, I believe there is a Skinwalker Ranch series on one of them Zaslav channels right now. Never have watched it, would never watch it. So what Boom Studios has done is they are, I guess, collaborating is the best way to describe it, with Kelleher and Knapp, and having Zach Thompson take one of their books or all of the stories that they have told over the years and the people that they've interviewed, and are trying to tell us the real story of what happened at Skinwalker Ranch, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. The shapeshifter thing and the UFOs and the time travel and the portals to other dimensions and ghosts and whatnot is very interesting. Certainly, there are a lot of people that have made some tourism out of Skinwalker Ranch and probably have made a lot of money off of Skinwalker Ranch. So for Boom Studios to try and get their beak wet, I do not have a problem with. What I have a problem with is the poor execution of this story. In that the premise is, and you find out by the end of issue one, the premise is that this story is being told through the case files of Knapp and Kelleher. You know, they're narrating this to you from their case file book. The problem, though, is that there are many times that while they are dropping into things about here's what people believe skinwalkers are, what they do is they narrate things in, you know, narration boxes or edit, not editor's boxes, but narration boxes that really don't need to be there. For example, Tom got home much later than he wanted. And we see Tom, it's night, it's dark time, and he's walking through the gates of his home. You don't need to tell us that. You could change that with like 2 a.m. or something like that. The hole in his checkbook weighed heavy on his mind. Well, let's have the character thinking those things. Don't just, you know, show, don't tell kind of thing. So I really think that the storytelling in how they are introducing this family to the high strangeness that's going on. In fact, UFOs show up at the end of the book. The high strangeness that's going on in this book, I think, has been treated as a disservice because it's being presented very sterile, very like doctor's office. We're doing an autopsy on this story. And even some of the dialogue is a little bit stiff. And I don't know how much input Zach Thompson had in this. If he was, you know, just legitimately going in and they're like, here's all our notes, do what you want with it. Or if Kelleher and Knapp are sitting there saying, oh, we want you to do it this way or whatever. But I didn't care for this. The way that this story is presented, I think, is very poor and is really a disservice to what's going on. Something that I think does a better job at telling a spooky high strangeness story is Project Blue Book by James Tinian. And who's the other person working on that one? I forget. But I think that that one is done much better than what we're seeing here in Hunt for the Skinwalker. The art is okay. Valerio Aburzo is the one that is doing the art in this. And it's okay. There's nothing special. There's nothing that you're going to write home about in this. There are some times where there is some strangeness in how characters are presented, especially this one guy with his cowboy hat as the brim continues to go from a 40-gallon hat to a, you know, just a little short pocket hat kind of thing throughout the series. I can forgive those kinds of things. There's nothing really spectacular about the character design and the art. And as much as I have been following the potential release of this comic for 6 months now, or whatever long it's been, 3 months since Boom first announced it. And I was excited about it because I am familiar with this story, not, you know, into the nitty gritty like a lot of people in the cryptid community might be. But I was very eager to see how they were going to present this. And I will say that I was very disappointed in this book. So disappointed that I'm only giving this a one slice of meatloaf out of five. I thought it was overall kind of unappealing and not well handled. Maybe it gets better in issue two when, you know, Kelleher and Knapp actually are supposedly becoming part of the story. But for right now, I just thought that this was not worth my time. And that's unfortunate. Maybe if you are someone that is a Coast to Coast fan, if you are someone that is very familiar with a Skinwalker Ranch, you might want to pick this up and maybe you get a little bit more out of it. Because instead of hearing these stories or reading them in a prose book, you're now getting to see things that are illustrated. And maybe that adds to your enjoyment of the story that's being spun about Skinwalker Ranch. But overall, I just didn't care for this. And I'm not going to read. I'm not going to pick up issue number two. So Unfortunately, Hunt for Skinwalker Ranch, or Hunt for the Skinwalker number one, is a big pass for me this week. Also, spinning out of real history, just like the Skinwalker Ranch is real. Rodrigo's
very real stuff.
Yes. Rodrigo, you're taking a look at one of the most notorious gangsters of all time, Al Capone, in a new book that comes out next week.
Yep. Coming out next week from Black Panel Press.
Yeah.
Writer Swan Merali, artist P.F. Radis. And that's kind of what I like initially hooked me on this is the art. It has a very specific style. Al Capone is not depicted as like a handsome person in this. He looks kind of like a little troll, and a lot of other like it's just like a very interesting visual design. Sort of like has a lot of curves, not a lot of angles, kind of a thing. So that's kind of what got me interested in looking at it. This is a full trade paperback. It's $30. It's like $29.99, and it's like about 170 pages. So it's not like a number one. This is like a complete, basically a complete biography of Al Capone as a graphic novel. It is told from a first person perspective, from Al Capone's point of view. I didn't sit down to do a lot of research, but the book in the afterword talks about, you know, the research that was done for it, and how there's actually big chunks of Al Capone's life that we don't know about, including, you know, he was called Scarface, including where he got those scars. So this book, as a narrative and a story that is being told, takes takes some historical information, but still sort of fills those gaps with, I don't know, fiction, conjecture. I don't know the best way to say it. I don't want to make it sound like it's a bad thing, but if you're coming into this book, you should know that first off, it's censoring Al Capone. And also that there are parts of Al Capone's life that we don't know what happened. So it's kind of, you know, maybe taking a best guess or something that they think is going to be good for the story. It, you know, reading through it, it makes me question, do we need a story in which notorious killer and gangster Al Capone gets, you know, something told from his perspective? I'm not sure. Definitely the book doesn't pull any punches with the stuff that Al Capone did or was reported to have done. So I don't feel like it's glossing over it. But of course, when you center a character, and he is in the center, like, we are inside his mind. Like, he, in this book, I believe, I don't know that this was ever said, but one of the devices is that he talks to his mom, and even after his mom passes, he continues to talk to his mom. And in the book, we see a representation of his mom talking to him and listening to him. So, yeah, obviously, it, like, you know, it takes some liberties to create the story. I enjoyed it. I'll give it 4 slices of meatloaf. The art, again, is unusual and interesting and fun. But, you know, take your grain of salt in that this is kind of a romanticized look at Al Capone's life. You know, he was a notorious gangster. Although the book does, once again, make the claim, which I believe is true. I for a long time I thought it was a myth, but I think it is true that they got him on tax evasion, and a lot of criminals that did much worse things are finally caught because of things like tax evasion or like simple like mail fraud or things like that. So yeah, an enjoyable read, definitely. If you are interested at all in Al Capone, you should check it out.
Very cool. Thank you for that, Rodrigo and Matthew. And dear listener, thank you for being part of the Major Spoilers podcast and the Major Spoilers experience. You know, we enjoy doing this show week after week. At least I do. I don't know about these other guys, but I know I enjoy doing this show for you guys each and every week. And with that comes, you know, costs and expenses. And fortunately, we have some very fine patrons who make this show possible. This week, we welcome Thomas Chambers, Thomas edited their pledge by becoming a yearly patron. And again, if you are someone that is a month-to-month patron, that's great. We really appreciate it. But when you pay for a full year in advance, you get access to all the great things at Major Spoilers, and you don't have to worry about those month-to-month charges. So you're like, hey, I've got, I don't know, $60 right now. I will sign up for the Silver Level membership for a full year, and I won't have to worry about it again. Or if you're at a higher level, I know some other members are at higher levels, etc. That is really a good way to do it. Just set it once and forget it. And you don't have to worry about it until the next year. And you get a little bit of a discount when you sign up at that yearly rate. And now is when we are asking you, dear listener, you who are not currently a patron, to become a $5 a month patron. That's all we're really looking for. Someone who is willing to step up and contribute $5 a month to keep the show going, to keep the lights on, to make sure we don't have to play the sad Matthew music as he walks away. Oh, I'm so sad. I'm so sad. Matthew's sad. We don't want to have to do that each week. So listen, if you enjoy the shows that we produce, if you want to hear more special presentations, if you want to hear more zaniness that happens in the Major Spoilers podcast pre-show, if you want to get access to all the bonus stuff, this week, it doesn't matter which pledge level you are at. I put up some blue moon photography that my son and I took for his astronomy class, and people seem to really like that. So I've got that for you in a wallpaper for either your mobile device or for your desktop. And that's just part of all the other bonus stuff that you get when you become a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. $5 a month. That's not a whole lot. $60 for the year. Step up. We're asking you, those of you who are not currently patrons, to step up, be a cool spoilerite, be one of our heroes, and get access to all of the cool stuff in our archive. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of bonus content. patreon.com/majorspoilers. This month, ladies and gentlemen, it is Crime Prevention Month. And remember, only you can prevent crime. So we are taking a look at the crime suspense stories from the EC archives. Specifically, this is Volume 4, which just came out a few years ago from Dark Horse Books. And so this is a collection of classic tales from Al Feldstein, Harvey Kurtzman, Johnny Craig, Jack Davis, Joe Orlando, and a whole bunch more. And if you are wanting to know why we have the Comic Code Authority, then you just need to open up any issue of the crime suspense stories, and you will find it right there. The premise is...
it was successful.
The premise is that crime does not pay, and you're always going to get caught for your crimes in the end in one way, shape, or form, which, you know, that was kind of the whole point of the Comic Code Authority, is if someone's doing something bad, they have to be caught for it. And that's kind of what happens in each of these. We get a story about... these goofy hitman who can't even poison a guy correctly, and then the guy finds out and decides to kill them instead. We get a story about a woman who wants to, and her lover who want to kill her husband by making it look like he's trampled by a horse, but instead they do get him trampled by the horse, but the husband finds out beforehand, kills the man. And so the woman, when the cops show up at the stable and wonder why this guy was trampled and burned to death, she's like, I have no idea. I was down in the basement of our house. And they go into the basement of the house. And sure enough, there's the dead body of the of her boyfriend that her husband killed. And so she goes to jail for the crime. A lot of it, what's the one where the house blows up because of a bomb and some alcohol? There's a lot of crazy stories in this.
Yeah.
it goes in many places, whether... the woman finds out that her husband is the person that's in charge of the, he's the hangman.
She finds this out when she ends up being hanged. Yeah,
yeah, because of infidelity. And the town doesn't cotton to any of that. So there are a lot of interesting stories in this. Matthew, what are your thoughts?
I love this stuff. So I think the one with the bomb you're thinking of is the anniversary, where the husband is poisoning her, but she's trying to blow him up.
Yes. Yep.
Or no, she's trying to blow her up. And he, anyway, and it gets to the end, and it's a whole Gift of the Magi thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where he gets blown up, but it's okay because he actually poisoned her wine.
Yeah.
I love this. There is nobody in the pages of this that is not someone that I don't look at and go, oh my God, oh my God, these guys are masters. This has Reed Crandall art, Jack Davis. You know Jack Davis from Mad Magazine, Bigfoot,
yeah, that's the
weird parodies. But
the one that I was referencing about
the
hoodlums that try to poison the guy and they screw up the sabotage because one of them is like, I'll kill this guy by giving him an overdose of insulin. And the other guy is like, I'll kill this guy by giving him a bunch of sugar, knowing that he is a diabetic and that'll kill him. And then the two cancel each other out. The story is called The Welchers. And man, yep. You look at that and you're like, instantly, if you were a fan of Mad Magazine, you recognize Jack Davis art throughout piece. And it's just masterfully done.
Joe Orlando, Bernie Krigstein. I'm a huge fan of EC Comics in general because all of my life, EC Comics have basically not necessarily been in public domain, but they've always been reprinted and easily accessible. So I've read tons of the crime suspense stories. A few of these actually got adapted for Tales of the Crypt. Mm-hmm. Or Tales from the Dark Side in the 80s. So there's a couple of these that I'm like, I've seen this one, but I'm pretty sure it had the Crypt Keeper. But yeah, if you go through here, I feel like this is a volume that would show anybody why the people who love EC Comics were known as fan addicts back in the day, because these are great. These are really, even the cheesiest, goofiest, weirdest story. Now for me, that's probably The Killer, where we have like 8 pages of hiding what this man does. And then the final panel, I am the hangman. I'm just,
So what's great about that story is it starts off from him looking out through prison bars. And you're thinking, oh, this is a guy that we are finding out why he commits the crime. And he's always going out and leaving his poor, pretty wife at home because he has to be in the family business. And no one, you know, he doesn't want to tell anybody what he does. Of course, this isn't modern day. This is an oldie-timey story.
Right.
And then finally he comes home one day and the house has been broken into and everything is a mess. And he goes to the police and they're like, no, we captured, you know, we caught your wife having sex with another man. And so she must be hung at dawn. And then she climbs up the gallows and then standing there is her husband. And he's like, I'm the hangman.
Great stuff. The guy who's like, oh, I'm going to murder my wife, but I'm going to claim temporary insanity and tell him I'm a werewolf. I'm a lycanthrope. So I'm going to kill my wife, but I'm also going to kill 4 other women. And then he forgets to take into account the total eclipse. I feel like there is something really just prototypical, almost like just built into the DNA of comics. When you look at these issues of crime suspense stories, this actually has one of the Notorious covers, issue 20.
Two of them.
Does it have two? Yeah, I know 20 is in here.
20 and 22.
20 is the one with the man being hanged where you can clearly see the broken vertebra in his neck.
Yeah, and 22.
That was one of the ones.
22 is the one where the head is being held with the axe in the body.
Oh.
So for what Matthew's referencing is, and it's real interesting because I'm getting ready to talk about this specifically in one of my classes this week. Where when people were rallying against comic books and there were the hearings at Washington, Gaines was brought before Congress to talk about, and specifically, if you can go and read the Gaines testimony, the question is, do you think it's appropriate to have a bloody axe and a severed head on the cover of your comic books? And of course, Ed Gaines is like, no, what would be inappropriate is if the head was held about 3 inches higher and you could see the blood dripping from the severed neck and the body moved a little bit so you could see blood coming out of the neck. That would be inappropriate, sir. And of course, that got him in trouble and got the Comic Code Authority kind of introduced and Gaines kicked out of the comic industry, so to speak.
And the thing, you know, the thing that's really horrifying is when you talk about the Comics Code Authority, a lot of it was specifically targeted to put EC and Gaines out of business.
Yeah, after his testimony. Yeah.
There are parts where they're like, you cannot have a book with horror or terror or crime in the title. And of course, EC had crime suspense stories. They had they didn't have Crime Did Not Pay at that point, but Biro did. And they had Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, Crypt of Terror. It was specifically designed to punish him for that horrific testimony that he, you know, always says he was crashing on his diet pills.
He was. I mean, the story is that he was up all night preparing for this. He was super nervous about it. He was on his methamphetamines for his weight loss and drinking just tons like and tons of coffee. Because, well, back then, methamphetamines were the way that you lost weight. but, you know, he was drinking coffee on speed, no sleep. And then he goes to Congress and he gives flippant answers and he's all jittery. I mean, we talk about somebody's like on goofballs. Literally, William Gaines is on goofballs in his testimony. The testimony, I think, is very funny when you read it or if you watch it, I think it's very funny. But if you're not tuned into what's going on, Gaines does come off as an incredibly self-entitled jackass, and he does make the entire comic industry look bad. I think he was the last day of testimony, if I'm not mistaken. All the other publishers had already gone before it, and they were, you know, willing, and they thought they had everything taken care of until Gaines' testimony, and then they're like, ah, crap, now we're going to have to go in and do something. And you're right, the way that the code is written is a lot of it, again, this is self-censorship, this isn't government censorship. The way that the code is written is specifically to punish Gaines. And the sad part is Gaines goes off and tries to do a bunch of other things that are not successful. He ends up selling so much of the company. The only thing that he kept a hold of in the end before EC had to close was this little magazine that was a humor magazine called Mad Magazine that he eventually sold to DC Comics. And that turns out to be the thing that's, even though it is the most successful thing that he has done, unfortunately, it's not the thing that people think of first when they think of EC.
Yeah. And I am one of those people. I've grown up and I taught my child as much as I could that it's not necessarily the things that you're seeing that are going to, you know, scar you for life. It's the context they're in and the way you deal with them. But that's also something that not everybody shares. And I don't want to explain, you know, something to someone else's child. You know, why does that man have a woman's head? And why does that axe look like it's covered with ink? Well, that ink is technically blood, but you can't show that. And you do get to a point in here where I feel like if you sit and read all 27 issues of crime suspense stories in a row, it is going to kind of mute the expectation here of that. Not necessarily a Twilight Zone ending, but kind of the karmic retribution for the evildoers. You know, you get to the end of this and of the couple who's like, oh, yeah, we're supposed to, we have to win $1 million, but we're going to kill a guy and bury him in our yard. And then they're like, oh, no, we put the money in your backyard. Those kind of twists are really, really fun, but they're definitely also twists that probably don't work in the year 2023, the way they did in the year 1954.
Rodrigo, has this turned you away from a life of crime and suspense?
Yes, I no longer want to live a life of suspense. I am now finishing all of my sentences right away instead of waiting for a dramatic moment. I'm not sure. Like, so many of these are not like the sort of crime that they were trying to prevent anyway. These comics are actually written from like a very conservative point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell because there's several stories that are like, well, I hate my wife, and then my girlfriend hates her husband. So the only thing that we can do is kill them. And it's like, is it? Because you could just leave. Like, you really could just leave together, go live somewhere else. And sure, like, I mean, what's going to happen? And the idea here is that socially, they would be pariahs, right? Mm-hmm. Or that then they wouldn't have access to like their money or their accounts or whatever. There's a lot of like unwritten stuff into these things that I think at the time you'd be like, oh yeah, that makes sense why this like, you know, very desperate person would commit murder. But now I look at them, you know, obviously from the viewpoint of where we're at in 2023. And I'm like, yeah, a lot of these could be solved just by like leaving. Like, you don't actually have to kill this person. Like,
yeah.
if your morality is like, well, I would just rather kill this person. That would make things easier for me.
And I think that may be one of the reasons why this is, at the time, successful, very successful, moderately successful, in that in the 1950s, you are looking at, here's what societal norms are expected of you, and here's a book that shows you all the lurid stuff that is going on that you only thought was possible because, you know, you're a moral person and you would never do these things. But then the book does it. And then it says, oh, if you were ever thinking of doing these things, look at what's going to happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is that, you know, why people slow down at a traffic accident to look, you know, there's kind of that, what is the word I'm looking for?
Voyeuristic?
Yeah, a little bit voyeuristic. Sure. Let's look at this taboo thing that we're not supposed to look at or discuss. Let's not talk about infidelity. Let's not talk about, you know, whatever spouse-icide is called. Murder, I guess, is what it's called.
I mean, I'm sure there's a specific word for it.
There's a weird story about embezzlement in this book, too. It's like, let's talk about all those things people kind of wish they could do, but society won't allow them to do. And I can see why this could be a very controversial series.
Yeah. It is. This volume, was it post Comic Code Authority?
No, this is pre Comic Code. No. So like I said, the Gaines testimony specifically, they're calling out issues 20 and 22 as part of their discussion.
Yeah. It's interesting because a big part of the Comic Code Authority was the way that stories were allowed to go. Right. And that criminals had to be punished for their crimes. And I would say 99% of the stories in this volume, criminals get punished for their crimes, either karmically or by actually being caught
by the law.
In a police.
Murderly.
So it's funny because, again, I learned about the Comic Code Authority before I really spent a lot of time looking at this stuff. Or it just kind of was all happening at the same time. So I assumed that most of these stories, you know, because you can write a story that has criminals in it where they commit crimes, but that's that's ancillary to the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not central to the story. And they have you can have two people and a story about their relationship and how it changes, and it just happened to be criminals, right? So I thought maybe that was going on, but I'm like, no, actually. Most of these stories, it's like a tiny minority of these stories have some sort of crime that somebody gets away with, right? Like they're like so rare. I wonder why that was even included.
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest...
a lot.
Go ahead, Matthew.
A lot of the stories reputedly were actually Feldstein and Harvey Kurtzman. Worked from what we were told from springboards that Bill Gaines would actually put together. And Bill Gaines was a big believer in trying to get more adult, not like adult, ooh, everybody's naked material, but adult oriented stories. Well, and that's in here too. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was a big fan of the lurid pulps and the My Father Was a Serial Killer stories. But I also feel like these are very heavily influenced by the dun dun da movies that you would see like on Svengoolie these days. So they were trying, and I feel like succeeding at creating a book for, or at least theoretically for, an older reader, maybe an adult comic book reader. And I think that's also one of the factors that tripped them up, because everybody presumes that comic books are for kids in 1955, and these are not.
No, in fact, and that's one of the sad effects of this series, in that because of the testimony and because of the Comic Code Authority and the severe clamping down on things like, you know, and you're right, you know, all criminals must be punished for their crimes. There's nothing in these comics that are allowing the criminals to get away with it. Right. But there are other things like passionate, embraces and, scantily, we would say scantily clad kind of stuff. Okay. What ended
infidelity
up happening?
Infidelity up and down.
Yeah, those
so
kinds of things.
Suggestive stuff.
This, yeah, but because of that, it killed female readership in comics, because by far the most popular genre in comics before the Comic Code Authority was romance comics. And we just talked about that last week with Jack Kirby's Love Stories. Romance comics were a huge thing. Comic Code Authority knocked out the romance genre almost entirely because of their restrictions, and 51% of your readership just went away.
Yeah.
And I find that very amazing.
The horror comics that really kind of put EC on the scene are definitely represented in here, or at least I think the sensibilities of those horror comics. And especially when we think about the traditional, what I would say is a Tales from the Crypt story, which is basically imagine the Twilight Zone, only meaner spirited and probably more axes in faces. But I feel like if you break down the story beats of here's a werewolf and then he does this and he does this and he does this, and you break down the story beats here of here's this weird man who wants to kill his wife so he can run off with his girlfriend, I feel like the actual structure, the thought process behind it is very similar to those horror books that really made EC a going concern. And I feel like calling this a crime book is not 100% true, because I feel like it falls for me into that realm of the horror books too, but it's also hard to separate that. It's almost like a genre unto itself, where it's both horror and crime, but it's neither horror nor crime.
Yeah.
Separately, if that makes sense.
It's like when I think of crime comics, right? And when people are like, these comics have to stop because they glorify crime, I think of organized crime comics, mm-hmm. right? Like stories about
Al Capone.
Gangsters. Yeah, Al Capone. Gangsters living the high life, you know, paying off crooked cops and shooting whoever they want and living however they want and fast cars and fast women and all that stuff, right? That's what I imagined they meant. And I've read a few stories like that. But the majority of these crimes are actually like crimes of passion, mm-hmm. right? They're like, it's almost all of them are a wife killing her husband, a husband killing his wife, or like the two of them killing someone else, right? It's like mostly like family stuff, like relatives, like brothers and mothers and stuff. It is just like small murder stories, and they don't quote unquote glorify crime. Like, it's just very clearly this like idea of like seduction of the innocent, that by like by just looking at these lurid images, like kids are going to turn gay, or like they're going to turn into like perverts, or
juvenile delinquents,
right? That somehow this is going to osmose into their little brains and turn them bad. And it almost has nothing to do with these comics, right? And you can tell, because after these comics, they went after TV and radio and everything else, right? Was it before?
No, depends on when they're going after. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that we're talking about in class, is here the movie industry said, hey, we will do self-regulation, and it hurt them so much. And then it's like, okay, well, let's look at other companies. Hey, let's look at the comic book industry and how they tried to self-regulate themselves and almost killed themselves in the process. Let's look at video game industry. Let's look at the record industry and how, you know, it's a great to go in and try to say we will govern ourselves, but it tends to go wildly into draconian measures in self-control. When really, just take out the man hacking his wife to bits on page 27, and the government will stay out of your business.
And that's the thing, it just becomes that, because everybody in then the board that approves or disapproves of things has a vested interest, right?
Yeah.
It's a conflict of interest up and down all the way. And so, it gets completely warped. It's like the government wasn't doing like super great, right? They weren't coming in with necessarily a legit worry about comic books.
No, I think government didn't really give a crap.
It was part of a larger sort of like modesty campaign.
Social movement. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the government wasn't coming in, all straight up either. And then they take this, and because they're inside the house and they, hate each other or have grudges or want to help themselves, just kind of warps into something that doesn't actually help anyone and just creates a lot of problems for everyone.
I think part of the reason why this may be so shocking in comic book form is this is 1950s. This is 1950s when these issues are published.
This is the Beaver times.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. We're post-war, we're nuclear family, we're doing all these things. So, yeah, you may hear about an occasional murder happening in the bad parts of town.
Did you hear about the murders in Kansas?
But in reality, as a whole, society is not exposed to murder on the screen every single day like we are today, right? So if you were to open this up and you're like, here's a man hacking his wife to death with a hatchet, that's something that is just like, this is bizarre and weird and not the norm for the 1950s, even though I'm sure that stuff was going on. It's just that it wasn't portrayed in the media the way that it is now post Kennedy assassination, where every single day, all you have to do is turn on the TV and it's like, hey, we're not going to censor this shot of this, this video of this man blowing his head off, but here you go. You've been warned. Boom. And you see it. We've really become desensitized to the amount of violence that we're seeing on TV. And so I can see where you're coming from, Rodrigo, when you're looking at this stuff and going, it's kind of tame. But I think in 1954, this stuff would have been like,
I mean, I didn't mean to say it was tame.
Yeah, no,
I
no,
meant
no, no. I'm just
say, yeah, it doesn't line up. It's like, if you take the government and the Comics Code Authority at their word, mm-hmm. that they're like, we right. want to create a place that's safer, that's not going to make kids want to become criminals, right? It's like, right. the lesson that you learn here is don't get married, right? if you want to take them at their word, definitely do not get married, because you'll get chopped up into pieces and fed to the dogs or something.
I guess.
In that one, he chopped himself into pieces and fed himself to the dogs, which right. is hardcore.
Like you do. And yes. I think that, the vehemence of that response, as Steven stated, would not have happened if it hadn't come from, the calls weren't coming from inside the house. I feel like the worry about these comics was not based in reality. It was based on the rest of the industry going, oh, God, we can't be even perceived as getting away with this. And nobody's actually going to go and read these comics and see past those lurid covers or those come on pages or the big things in the front that go, hello, kiddies.
This is really, the Tencent plague. This is really Wortham doing his job to stir up what's going on in, quiet America at this time. And it's literally the fear of government regulation that led to the Comic Code Authority, that led to these hearings, because so many people were up in arms. People were burning their comic books. We are not 10 years, not even 10 years out from Nazis burning books in Germany to kids gathering up books and records and burning them at church socials in giant bonfires because of what's going on at this time period in America. And so, any industry, like I said, the movie industry was like, no, we don't want the government to come in and regulate us. Comic book industry is like, we don't want you to come in and regulate us. We've seen what happens when you've tried to regulate radio and television, and look how that has backfired. And so this concept of we're going to regulate ourselves really, really blows up in people's faces.
Did I hallucinate?
You did.
An episode of this show where we covered Crime Does Not Pay?
You did.
About 4 or 5 years ago.
No, I don't believe we've talked about Crime Does Not Pay.
We've done horror comics before, so maybe there was some crossover.
I don't know. I remember, I swear that we either talked about it or it came up in context of something else. But
I mean, we've talked about the Comics Code Authority before.
Yeah.
That may be where it came into play. But I feel like when it comes to these stories, whether you're talking about them as crime stories or suspense or whatever, or crime suspense stories, which, by the way, I love a good portmanteau. Suspense stories.
Suspense stories.
Right. It's guaranteed to A, be copyrightable, and B, mess up your autocorrect for the rest of your natural life. But I like the fact that these creators seem to take the material seriously, in as much as, oh, we want to have people going, at the end. We want them to be creeped out, and we want them to get to the end of the story and go, well, that guy got chopped in half, but he kind of deserved it. And if you look at the careers of these creators, these are people who go on to write Prince Valiant. These are people who go on to create Mad Magazine. These are people who go on into the industry and just really transform the comic book industry over the next two and a half decades. And seeing them working here is kind of like that point where it's like, hey, look, here's 17-year-old Elvis in his little gold jacket dancing somewhere. And it's you can't help but just enjoy seeing these young creators who are eventually going to change whatever it is that they do into something even cooler. Yeah. Just seeing them do this stuff and being like, okay, we could just do this straightforward, like a Crime Does Not Pay story, which is, gets kind of freaky at the end and it's all drawn by Don Rico. Or we could just go nuts.
Well, and so here's what I'll say. The art in this is fantastic. The structures of the stories, such as here's how it's going to be done, here's how they're going to have karma pay retribution on them, etc. Very, very well done. A lot of the writing, not so good. And I say this because blocks of these comics, blocks of these stories have them. Monotony is the one that I'm thinking of here, where show don't tell kind of thing. And it's the story about this man who ends up embezzling all this money from this old woman who's a real mean person. But it's like, right. Mrs. Courtright wrapped her cane on the floor. Never mind. Give me the withdrawal slip. And it's like, you don't need to really put that in there. Here you are, Mrs. Cartwright. Mrs. Cartwright scrawled her name across the dotted line at the bottom of the withdrawal slip and handed it back to Milton. Now the money. Yes, ma'am. Here you are. Milton turned to go. Mrs. Courtright wrapped her cane. Aren't you forgetting something, young man? Sign my bank book. And it's just like, I don't think we need just this wall of text narration telling us what we're seeing in the panel. And that's not the only story. Most of the stories have those giant, I'm describing to you what's going on in the panel.
Right.
And I think it was after the first issue, I just stopped reading that stuff altogether and just focused on the panel and the dialogue.
You can skip most of that stuff. So arguably, it's part of the style of the time, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And something that is part of them, right? That like very tight to what's happening narration, right? Mm-hmm, not a narration that is like, this is how I felt, or like, she wrapped her cane and it sounded like the sound of chains falling upon, right. Like, it's not like that, right? It just tells you exactly what's happening. Is definitely part of the time and the sort of thing that, if you were to make a parody of these books, you'd have a field day with, because it is so prevalent and it is so kind of unnecessary, mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, partially because the art is so good.
Yeah.
Right.
It's yeah.
Like part of the reason why, like, we've seen some like Spider-Man stories that have tons of blocks of text.
Mm-hmm.
And whoa, part of the reason for that is because they have like tiny panels that you're trying to read in like a newspaper print, like comic, right? Or newspaper, right? It's like the printing's not great. The art is tiny. And also, who knows if the colors are actually going to land where they do. And it's like, well, text narration in that sense where it's like, it tells you that Spider-Man sent something and jumped and then he used his webs and then he flipped over there. Okay. All right. I can see that. But in this, the art is so good. And if you read superhero comics and come to this, like all of these like very true to life proportional humans doing very true to life mundane things. Mm-hmm. Like you don't need that narration there. And it literally draws you away from the art.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's another influence of those pulp stories, those books that you'd go and buy and you'd be like, oh, and then the killer inched closer.
But is interestingly,
it, is it necessary? Yeah, probably not. But it's it makes for such an interesting tone to me.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's,
it
that's
feels
the thing
like.
Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say it feels like, and this has been some problems with EC Comics, in that both Ray Bradbury and I believe Rod Serling had some stern words to say about the EC Comics because they felt like they were lifting their stories. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, these stories read like a Rod Serling narration. You're sure. Bob Smith, and your wife right. is a horrible person, so you're deciding to kill her. We are following your story now. Or actually, this is the wind-up one, this guy that gets... quote unquote paralyzed in a car accident because his wife's trying to murder him and she's going to roll him off the docks. Your name is Charlie Ashlin. You are independently wealthy. You own a luxurious duplex apartment in the city and a comfortable summer home, blah, 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 blah. And then we get to the wife trying to kill him for his money story. So it just a lot of times feels like that Twilight Zone-y stuff.
It is interesting because these comics, I feel, really evolved the art. Like they just kept coming up. They just kept making better and better, hiring better artists. And also the artists that were already working on them just improving by miles while simultaneously really not evolving the prose that went along with it. Right. So it's like it was kind of secondary to come up. Like all you have to do is come up with that like twist to the story. Mm-hmm. And get there somehow, and the art will carry you the rest of the way, which is true. I think all three of us love these comics because the art is so good, and not necessarily because these stories just like completely baffle us, although, you know, a couple of swerves in this I really wasn't expecting.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been Serling, because Serling didn't start his Twilight Zone-y stuff until 59. So, I mean, these guys would have shut down by 56, but I definitely do remember somebody, and I can't.
I think it's Ray Bradbury.
Well, I know Bradbury did, because Bradbury actually sent them a letter that basically said, "Hey, you guys, really enjoyed your adaptation of my story. I notice you haven't sent me my check yet.
My royalty check."
Yeah, and they sent him the royalty check and negotiated several more. And I'm just like, that's the point right there where you understand why Rachel Bloom says what she says about Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just, I don't know. There's something about this that feels, if some people talk about jazz, they're like, jazz is this truly American art form. And it comes from, you know, these marginalized cultures. And I feel like in a lot of ways, these comic books kind of do too. You do have that, you know, you have the people who are writing these books and putting these stories together. And I really do appreciate just the sheer craftsmanship, even when they are, you know, hitting with a wall full of text, of what's going on in here. And if nothing else, I feel like if you feel like a person, you're like, I don't love Green Lantern, I don't love Spider-Man, I love comics as a whole thing, you're definitely going to want to look at some EC. You're going to want to just go through EC and find what works and what doesn't, and just look at what they did and see how the building blocks of this are really the comic industry of today.
One thing that I will say that is probably the worst thing about this comic, or this series, is the lettering. the lettering is just so typewriter, you know.
EC Comics typeset their comics. They didn't have letterers.
Yeah.
So they would literally get a typesetting machine, like if you were putting together a block of copy for a newspaper, and just bam, 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 get it down there. The Leroy tool is what they refer to it.
Yeah, it doesn't.
And you would just like pow, pow, pow.
That is the worst part about this entire stuff. Art great, story's very good.
Can you imagine what a Todd Klein would have added to these stories? Or, you know, one of those...
Just anyone who's a letterer, just a letterer, would add so much to these stories.
Do you think that at the times when like somebody is screaming and then gurgling to death, and like the thought bubble is like sort of like melting with it, was that like a weird block of text that they set on a press? Do you think that some of it was like actually handmade?
The Leroy tool that they used wasn't like a block of text, but it was literally, so imagine like kind of like the combination of a protractor and a ruler and a stencil. So you'd go down the list and you'd move and you'd go boom and you'd have your little pin, and then you'd run the ink or the pen that you're using would run down through. You'd stick it in the stencil and be like S, U, S. So it's not something where it's like typey, 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 and somebody's actually putting it together, but it's just, it's much faster. And I feel like, you know, takes a lot of the art out of the art of lettering the comic. So you're just like, boom, 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 boom.
How common was hand lettering at this point? Was it just like it is today, just kind of around and available?
Yes. I mean, the original books were hand lettered. If you go back to like Siegel and Schuster, Schuster in those earlier or the earliest works would do his own lettering. And I know Will Eisner would do his own lettering. You could go back and a lot of these old Golden Age comics, even older than the CC stuff, you won't see credited actual people doing it. The letterer, sometimes the letterer and the colorist would just be the artist on the book.
Sure.
But I think that the letterer as a separate thing came around in the 1950s when, you know, you started having like these production houses going, we're putting together X number of books for Dell. Somebody's going to write it. Somebody's going to take that and he's going to draw it. And while he's drawing the page, the next guy's going to put in the lettering. The next guy's going to do that. So they definitely were there, but I feel like in 1954, we were probably right around a point where we started seeing the letterer as a separate entity, but still about another 15 years before anybody said, hey, I recognize that guy's work as a letterer.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. All right. I like it. Rodrigo, you like it or hate it?
Oh, yeah.
Matthew, you like it or hate it?
Great comics.
I love it.
All right, then. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. You can find a link to purchase Volume 4. This is issues 19 through 27. Again, I picked this because it did contain the two big covers, the two big books that were part of the Gaines testimony to
the
Senate.
Choppy head cover.
Yeah, and I think they are worth picking up. And so if you want to support this show in a little way, you can use that Amazon affiliate link. We get very little back from that, but I think the publishers, especially like Dark Horse, like to see that their books that are out there are still being picked up. And of course, if you want to pick up any of the individual issues, the Al Capone or the Birds of Prey or the Hunt for the Skinwalker Ranch, we have links to those in the show notes as well. That is where we are going to wrap things up this week. Next week, something a little different because Stumarak demanded it. It's the Knights of the Dinner Table, a real indie comic book. Lots of fun. We'll talk about that next week. Why? Because we know that you love comics and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Fat Dick's Ray Vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic bookstore guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. If I'm Stark Raven, it's like a man of iron. Might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. But would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being in the Middle East with a King Santo and soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2023 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.